Now, one final thing I want to mention to you. When we look through the archaeological record, we discovered that when Israel, with Joshua, invaded the land of Canaan, there were primarily two kinds of topographies. There were the level plains, and there was the hill country. And the Israelites mostly took over the hill country. And they left a lot of the plain area alone. Do you know why they did that? Because the people in the plains had chariots, and they didn't. And chariots were an advanced form of warfare that were not easily countered by people who were mostly on foot. So rather than depend upon the Lord to help them fight these people, they mostly prosecuted their war in the land of Canaan in the hill country where chariots were not very effective. But because they left those plains alone, over time, the Israelites intermarried with the people among the plains and began to adopt some of their religious practices and incorporate them into their worship of Yahweh with a kind of syncretism that eventually spelled disaster for Israel. Does this make sense, everybody? Okay. So after Joshua had done as much as he could do, if you read in Joshua 23, he assembles the people. By the way, in the first five books, you have the Pentateuch, and then the next group of books are called the historical books. Joshua is the first of the historical books in the Old Testament. And it recounts the history of the conquest of the land of Canaan. So in chapter 23 then, Joshua assembles the people together, all of the Israelites. And the text reads that he is well advanced in age and that he's not going to live much longer. And so he wants to leave some kind of a lasting impact upon the Israelites before he dies. And he assembles them all together. It's a very dramatic thing. It's huge. I have no idea how many people were there. But he assembles them to make sure that they have made the commitment to God that they were to have made. That finalized itself in what we call a covenant. And that covenant that was finalized was based on something that was pretty prevalent in the land of Canaan at the time, called the suzerain vassal treaty, modeled largely after the Hittite tribes of that time. And so I'll talk a little bit more about that, but the covenant then followed very similarly to what we know to be the suzerain and vassal treaty. King and servant. Suzerain meaning king, vassal meaning servant, right? So, in chapter 24 then, we come to where Joshua is speaking to his people. And this is the primary text that I want to speak on. But this is one of these texts that you would find if you went to a Christian bookstore, which are about extinct right now because of the internet. But if you were to go to a Christian bookstore, you would typically find this as one of the more popular texts on a placard, on a poster, on a picture, or whatever. And the text is Joshua 24, verse 15, E. By the way, I don't know if you know this. So when you see 15 and I put E there, do you know what that E stands for? That's the clause. So you know a sentence has clauses, right? So there are five clauses in verse 15, and so it's clause E. It's the fifth one. If I put another five there, it would look like Joshua 1:155. So we put E there so that I'm telling you this because so much of what I do now is Bible study, and I want us to be able to reference more easily how we get to where we're at in the Scriptures. So it's Joshua 24, verse 15, that particular clause. And it is this: but as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. So when you look at that particular text, it deserves explanation, and it deserves a broader context so that you can fully appreciate the significance of what Joshua is saying. Let me ask you this question. I'm assuming that when you read this text, that would be something that everybody in this room could rally around. That as a Christian, this would be something that we would all certainly want to say is true of us. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. That's what we're about. That's why we exist. That's what we do. So let me ask you this question. If this text from Joshua is absolutely true of you, what will that look like in the year of 2020 for you? You go on to the next slide, Jordan. If this text from Joshua is absolutely true for you, what will that look like in the year of 2020? Look, Joshua was near the end of his life. He felt it incumbent upon himself to take some time and to do some examination, to reevaluate where Israel was and what they were willing to be committed to. Now, I know that every time we cross over into a new year, there are some people, although this is kind of losing its popularity, but they do look back and they evaluate their life over 2019. There was this interesting meme that came up on my Facebook. It said, 2019, worst year ever. Now, probably they lost their iPhone or something like that, you know, so they thought, like, this is the most horrible thing could ever happen to anybody, right? And then right below, worst year ever was 1665, the year in Europe that the bubonic plague killed around 25 million people, one-third of the European population. That was probably a worse year. I'm just guessing, right? So that's what some people do. But my question for you and for us is that it's always a good thing to sit down and ask ourselves the question at a certain point, how was this past year? What was good and what wasn't so good? How can things be better than what they were? How do I put legs under that? What would I identify as being good, and how can I make that better? What would I identify as being bad, and how I can fix that through Christ? So here we are. If this is true of us, but as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord, that's an easy thing to emotionally get next to. It's a much more difficult thing to work it out in our everyday life. And that will not happen by itself. There isn't anybody here in this room that has ever achieved anything of any significance that just kind of happened by itself. Right? If you have a good job, you worked for that good job. If you have children, I'm pretty sure you worked for them as well. If you have a good family, you probably worked hard to make that family a good family. If you're in great health, you worked hard to make that great health take place. If you have a great faith, it's not something that happens unintentionally or in an accidental sort of way. It happens because we take the time to evaluate our life, to consult the Lord, to know what it is that we can do that would be better than what we've done before, and to work out intentionally and with specifics about how to do that for ourselves. That's what Joshua was doing here. He wanted to make sure. He wanted to give Israel the opportunity to reflect upon their true relationship with Yahweh, and then from that decide where they wanted to go from there. So I'll ask you again, if this text from Joshua is absolutely true of you, if you want it to be true, what will that look like in the year of 2020? Now, when Joshua did this with those people, it's interesting to note that this event, this meeting took place near a place called Shechem. Now, Shechem is important. This is the amazing thing, many of the amazing things about Scripture, because oftentimes these things are separated by dozens, if not hundreds of years. For example, this meeting, this magnificent meeting, where everyone, all of Israel, was supposed to re-examine the nature of their relationship with Yahweh and decide where they were going to go from there. At this place, Shechem symbolically represented many, many other things. For example, it was in Shechem the Lord first promised the land of Canaan to Abraham. Here they are, all of them, standing in Shechem. And hundreds of years prior to that, Abraham was promised by God that this was going to be the land of milk and honey. This was going to be the promised land that he would give to his descendants. And there they are. And everybody there knew it. This was evidence of God's faithfulness in their lives. That the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were faithful in following God, and he was faithful, and he delivered to them the land of the promise. It was in Shechem that Jacob destroyed the idols which had been brought from Mesopotamia, that is, the land of Ur and Chaldee, where Abraham came from. So it was here, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the grandson of Abraham, it was Jacob who later became Israel, renamed Israel, who destroyed the idols from the land of Mesopotamia. That's important to note because the discourse in Joshua 24 is all about Israel not following these other gods. They were destroyed in this very place by their forefather Jacob. Shechem was also important because that was where the law of Moses was officially enacted. So you have the land of the promise. You have the promise that took place in the land of Shechem. You had Jacob, who in many respects was the forefather of what it meant to destroy the idols that would destroy them if they followed them. And then you had the law of Moses, which is all about following Yahweh, being obedient to him, and not following these other gods. The irony would have been impossible to miss of what Joshua was attempting to establish there. So, what he was establishing there was what I talked about earlier, was the beginning of Israel's suzerain and vassal treaty. And so, I'll just say this quickly because there are other things I want to get to. But a treaty like that had three parts to it. A preamble, there were stipulations, and there were blessings and curses. And when you read Joshua 24, as we're going to try and do a bit today, you will see that there's a preamble, like, this is who we are, this is where we came from, this is what we're about, this is who we're connected to, and if that is to be maintained, these are the stipulations. These are the things you have to do. So when a king subjugated another land, he would set up this suzerain and vassal treaty, and he would say, I am your king, you are in a relationship with me, I will treat you fairly, but in order for me to treat you fairly, these are the things that you have to do. If you don't do these things, then these are the things I'm going to do. And so that's the third part, the blessings and curses. And so through Joshua 24, you will see that it follows the outline of what we know to be a suzerain and vassal treaty. And it was very serious. And again, no one could have missed it. No one in that group could have missed that this was basically a treaty that they knew happened among earthly people, but here the God of the universe was establishing with them a suzerain and vassal treaty that was very, very serious and official. So if you want, turn to Joshua 24. Let's begin with verse 14, where it says, "Now therefore, fear the Lord and serve him. Now therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the rivers in Egypt and serve the Lord." So we have here four important. Now, by the way, if you have the NIV, you will not find the word sincerity in there. So the translators for the NIV assume the word sincerity. The word sincerity is in the text, but they tried to make it a little less wordy. So if you have the ESV, you will see that it says, "Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness." There are four words here that you need to pay attention to. We need to pay attention to. "Now therefore fear." That's not the kind of primal fear that people are mostly associated with, like if you're afraid of ghosts or if you're like a big dog is chasing you through the neighborhood or whatever. That's not that kind of fear. What we're talking about here is the kind of fear where you revere, you honor, you respect. That when you're in the presence of someone great, you understand, feel, and sense and know their greatness. And you honor that. So, do we fear the Lord? Go on to the next slide, Jordan, if you would. This is, do we fear the Lord? Do we in 2020, will we fear the Lord? Will we revere him? Will we respect him? I'm not talking about a casual nod. I'm talking about waking up every day and understanding that we live by the grace of God. And that for any one of us in this room, whatever you have because of the grace of God. That everyone in this room who may have less, and for those who have more, regardless, life could be much, much worse than what it is now. But God blesses us. There's more to that, but I won't have time to get into it. Number two, do we serve God? So, Joshua standing before all those people, and he's just saying, basically in a very poignant way, you have to live your lives in a manner that you serve, that you live in subjugation to God, that you understand that you are subservient to him, that you submit to him in a way so that when he wants to use you in your life, it's not something that you do grudgingly, but it is something that you are eager to do. So, have you ever gone to a store, a department store, or been on the phone with somebody, and they were supposed to help you find something, get something, and your encounter with them was like, they were doing as little as they possibly could. They were getting paid to serve you, right? But they did the minimum. And when you were done in that engagement with them, you were just really frustrated because you didn't feel like you were getting what you were paying for in terms of being served well. Have you ever had an encounter with somebody where when they were serving you, they were eager to help you? They went above and beyond what they were supposed to do. Maybe they couldn't find it for you. He said, okay, well, I'll keep looking. And they called you back and said, hey, I found this thing. I just thought I want you to let you know that, you know, this is, you're like, oh my gosh, where did you come from? And your tribe multiply manifold, you know, like it's just so hard to find people like that. But when you find them, it's so refreshing. When we serve the Lord, are we the first or are we the second? Do we do only what we have to do? Or are we eager to do more? And we're eager to do more because we love to serve Him. And that's what Joshua's talking about here. Look, if in any, I don't care what kind of worker, what kind of profession or anything like that, how many of you would want to field an army in a war that meant this nation's very existence? How many of you would want to field an army that only did what they absolutely had to do? Would you have any confidence in that at all? No, and you shouldn't. But we're God's army. How much confidence does He have in us? Are we eager to serve in 2020? In this church, in our neighborhood, and in our families, are we eager to serve? Are we sincere? So he's talking about serving God, fearing the Lord, serving Him, and being sincere. Sincere. So that's part of that joy. It's a desire. It's not a duty. When we look at our lives, do we patronize God? There's no one here that likes to be patronized. Right? I mean, patronization means simply that I'm acknowledging your presence. I understand that there's some kind of contractual agreement that I have to do something for you, and I only do what I have to do, and then after that, we're done. So it's a little bit related to what I was saying earlier. So in 2020, how do we, in this room, how do we intend to serve with sincerity? I mean, really, I think there are a few things in life more compelling than the Christian who is sincere in their service to Christ. I mean, because I think that's incarnational. I mean, I think that people are taken by that. And are we faithful? Are we faithful? In other words, is there a clear delineation between what our real priorities are? Because our lives, look, I'll just tell you this. You know, Tertullian once said, the seed of the church is the blood of her martyrs. That the persecution of Christians in China has launched the greatest outpouring of the growth of the church in the history of the world. And it was the persecution of the church that did that. The number one enemy, in a material sort of way, of the church is affluence. It's affluence because affluence provides for us any number of distractions that take on a lordship kind of appeal. We can afford to pay for it. And because we can afford to pay for it, we do it. And because it brings us pleasure, we do it a lot. And it takes us away. I mean, by the way, I mean, it's not lost on me that we're in one of the greatest economic times in the history of this country, and the attendance of churches nationwide is going down. the giving in churches nationwide is going down. Now, there are a whole bunch of reasons, but one of them has to do with affluence. So, affluence is another kind of God sometimes. It allows for these other smaller gods that become bigger priorities for us. I'm not trying to overly spiritualize anything. I'm 59 years old. I've done it myself. So in this very first sentence here, it helps to set the stage about what Joshua is saying. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. He is saying that we will do that because I fear and honor God. We will do that because He is a priority and I will live my life sacrificially for Him. Me and my family, He is saying we will do that because we are sincere. I mean, I'll get to the text. I'm certainly not going to get to everything today, so I'm going to have to carry this over for next Sunday. But he goes on to, basically he's saying, look, choose this day who you will serve. Maybe it will be the gods that our father Abraham had in Mesopotamia. Maybe it will be the gods that you had in Egypt under Pharaoh. And you see how well that turned out. But as for me, you can do that if you want. If you think it's evil, I mean, that's what the RSV says. The NIV doesn't say this. The RSV says, if you think it evil to follow God, then choose these other gods. And the truth of the matter is that certainly secular society and some Christians believe that it's just out of balance to put God as your number one priority. That all other things revolve around it. God does not revolve around all those other things. So are we faithful? What things in our lives in 2020 will compete for our faithfulness to God? List them out. So I met with a group of guys this past Thursday. We talked about this very thing. And I asked them this question. But as for me and my house, who we will serve the Lord, what will that look like in 2020 for you? So I'm going to take the rest of this, because I've only gotten through like 3 or 4 pages of my notes here, but I'm going to take the rest of this next week and unpack it, Joshua 24 more, because it's really profound. It's very poignant. It's really important. And he really, I think, gets at a lot of the dynamic that gets in the way of people who can fear the Lord and serve Him gladly and sacrificially, who are sincere in their faith and who want to be faithful. What will faithfulness look like for you in 2020? What are the things vying for your attention? Where do we spend time and energy disproportionately so that God is put on the back burner and everything else is on the front? The church in the world in which we live today, that world is so toxic. Look, I just want to say to you, the reason why Israel eventually succumbed to the world that surrounded it was because they believed they were patronizing God. They did what only they had to do. They were not as intentional as they should have been. And as a result, by the time the last kings of both Israel and the northern kingdom, Samaria, came to power, they were actually practicing other religious faiths in a way that was worse than the Canaanite tribes they had replaced. And if we're not careful, then we can allow that kind of a thing to happen in our lives as well. That world out there needs Christians who are what Joshua describes in Joshua 24:14. Let's read it again. Now therefore fear the Lord and serve Him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt. Put them away. In 2020, put away those things that compete with God in our lives. Let's do that. Let's list them out. Let's find people in our lives who will help us in that kind of a way. Let's commit ourselves to a new kind of faithfulness than what we've had in the past. If it's good in the past, great, let's make it better. If it's bad in the past, then let's make it better than what it was.